Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, December 28, 2017. Authorities in Jonglei State have arrested 9 suspects in connection with inter-clan killings.
Still, there is tension between the two clans, and we are keeping the army there, the police, and members of the armed forces, and we are engaging the two sides to start the process of reconciliation.
And a civil society activist says South Sudanese have lost trust in the warring parties.
The feedback that we get from the South Sudanese citizens, both within and outside the country, appears to be skeptical. They are not so optimistic about the cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed by the parties to the conflict.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in Jonglei State have arrested chiefs and youth leaders for allegedly participating in the killing of at least 22 people and wounding 18 others during inter-clan clashes over grazing land in Bor South County. The commissioner of Bor South County says many houses were also burned down and more than 2,000 people, including women and children, have been displaced. For VOA News, Deng Gai Deng reports from Bor.
Eyewitness Aka Hukwol says he does not know who started the fighting in his village last week. He says he too was shot when he went off his house to find out the cause of the fighting.
I heard that there was fighting in the cattle camp on the island. When I was just moving in my village, after some minutes, I fell into an ambush. They shot at me and wounded me in my legs. I was not in the cattle camp. I am just living in my village.
The commissioner of Bor South County, Deng Maburding, says the fighting started between two clans over grazing land and spread quickly to other villages on Friday.
It is true that there is violent conflict in Bor South County. This fighting erupted on 22nd, 12, 2017 between youth in the cattle camps on the island. At the same time, it is spread to villages on the eastern part of River Nile. The immediate cause of fighting is contest over grazing land on the island. At the moment, we have confirmed 22 persons dead and 18 others wounded from both sides of the conflict.
Deputy Director of Bor Civil Hospital, Daniel Ayual, says doctors are treating 11 people for gunshot wounds and have transferred 8 others for specialized medical care in Juba. The governor of Jonglei State, Philip Aguirre, says the police are holding 9 suspects in the inter-clan conflict fighting, which started last week, and that is threatening to engulf the estate.
Some of the culprits are apprehended for investigations. Apprehended are 9. These are mainly sheep and 2 youth leaders.
The commissioner of Bor South County says more than 200 women and children have been displaced after the houses were burnt down.
Because fighting took place right away in the residential area, and there has been houses that were burned down. Other irresponsible people took advantage of destroying properties of the other people. Which is very bad, which is not good. There has never been such a conflict in my county. It is first of its kind.
The police commissioner of Jonglei State, Major General Chola Tim Jonget, says he has dispatched his forces to stop the fighting.
Now the security forces are fully in control of the situation. Some have been dispersed, extended into backward areas. I mean the villages, forces have been deployed there to detect those who are trying to be in hiding there.
Governor Aguirre says even though there is tension in Bor South County, his office is working to restore calm in the area.
Still, there is tension between the two clans, and we are keeping the army there, the police, and members of the armed forces, and we are engaging the two sides to start the process of reconciliation. A team is heading there now, and every day we are sending a team to engage the two sides.
Governor Aguirre appeals to the people of Jonglei to remain calm and avoid inter-clan violence over resources in the state. He warns residents that the police will arrest individuals who break the law. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Civil society leaders who participated in the Addis talks to end violence in South Sudan say South Sudanese have no trust in the warring parties. Rajab Mohandis signed a ceasefire deal on behalf of civil society groups. He says he continues to receive negative feedback from South Sudanese who are expressing doubts about the implementation of the ceasefire agreement signed by armed and unarmed groups. The activist says the government and the various armed groups should respect the ceasefire agreement to avoid the wrath of IGAD countries and the international community on South Sudan.
The feedback that we get from the South Sudanese citizens, both within and outside the country, appears to be skeptical. They are not so optimistic about the cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed by the parties to the conflict. And they keep mentioning that they have seen this a number of times and that the parties have not held up to their responsibilities to implement the provisions of their previous agreements. So this one, in their view, may not be different. It will just follow the same trend. So this is the point of concern that most of the citizens seem to have.
Since the ceasefire agreement was signed in Addis Ababa last week, could you bring us up to date on some of the issues that happened from that time to date?
In the period of the negotiations in Addis, there were quite a number of issues of confrontations. And when this peace ceasefire was signed, we followed very closely to how the parties would stand up to their commitment to cease fire completely and also stop hostile propaganda, protect civilians, and provide or facilitate safe access to humanitarian services. However, the reports that we're getting from our colleagues who are our focal persons in the different locations in the country, there are cases of gunshots still. And as you may know, the spokespersons of the government forces and the opposition forces have been trading accusations of attacks on their positions. So it appears like even if the country is largely silent, there are areas where there are confrontations. There are reports of confrontations in Mundri. There are reports of confrontations in Leech State, particularly. And so these are areas of concern, and this will only add to frustrations of citizens who tend to believe that the parties may not hold up to their responsibility to honor the cessation of hostilities that they signed.
The responsibility for implementing this ceasefire agreement lies squarely on the various stakeholders who signed the deal in Addis Ababa. I was there in Addis and I saw you as one of the signatories to this ceasefire deal. What are you going to do to ensure that it's respected?
Well, first of all, our role is to work with the parties to be able to support in terms of disseminating this agreement to citizens and also, most importantly, to the forces. And we understand, first of all, that there are challenges in our country. There are difficulties with logistics. And given this economic situation we have, we believe it may be difficult for the parties to effectively reach out to all their forces to disseminate this information. We are aware of the orders issued by the parties, especially those that have military components to the conflict. And that is really positive, but of course, more needs to be done. On our side as the civil society, we will be supporting these parties in disseminating this agreement and also monitoring this agreement to provide reports so that these reports will inform decision makers, the parties, and also the mediators on the situation or status of implementation of the cessation of hostilities agreement.
You speak on behalf of the people who are not able to speak in South Sudan because of the various restrictions on freedom of speech. And at the same time, you also have a responsibility to hold the government accountable, or rather the various parties who signed the agreement, you have a responsibility to hold them accountable. Now, with the reports, you are telling me that there are skirmishes in certain areas of the country. What are you going to do with these reports? I mean, this is a violation of what they have signed. They violated it hours after they signed it.
We are investigating. We're working with our colleagues who are in those locations. We have peace monitors. We are focal persons in those locations. We are working with them to establish exactly these reports, confirming these reports, and we will put together our report. We're actually working on our report, the report for the monitoring of this cessation of hostilities, and we will share this report in an honest manner with the parties so that they see where things have not worked out well, and we hope that these reports will help them enhance their efforts in getting information across to the forces to cease hostilities.
Reading the text of the ceasefire agreement, it does not say what should happen in case one party violates the agreement.
Well, of course, the agreement says there will be consequences. First of all, travel restrictions and a number of actions, including direct intervention of the IGAD member states into South Sudan to protect civilians and end the violence.
That's Rajab Mohandis, the executive director of the South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections. He was speaking with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala, earlier today. A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund finds 2017 as a particularly brutal year for children caught in conflict. Children around the world, including those in South Sudan, have been subject to shocking levels of attacks by the warring parties. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says there is no safe place for children caught in conflict. The report finds children are being targeted and exposed to attacks and brutal violence in their homes, schools, and playgrounds. This in blatant disregard of international laws established to protect the most vulnerable. The report presents a numbing catalog of abuse and conflicts around the world, in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and even in Europe, in eastern Ukraine. It reports children are deliberately targeted, used as human shields, killed, maimed, and recruited to fight. Children are raped, forced into marriage, abducted, and enslaved, and UNICEF says the physical and mental impact of this brutality upon children is unbearable and deeply traumatic. This video of Rohingya refugees on a riverbank in Bangladesh, newly arrived after fleeing violence in Myanmar, is heartrending. It shows groups of weeping children and a severely malnourished baby treated by a UNICEF doctor. With the right nutrition, some of these starving children will survive, but many others will not. The report details the direct and indirect price children are paying in several African conflicts. It notes a dramatic increase in violence in Central African Republic has led to children being killed, raped, abducted, and recruited by armed groups. It notes 850,000 children have been driven from their homes in the Kasai region of Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 19,000 children have been recruited as soldiers by armed groups in South Sudan. And in northeast Nigeria and Cameroon, at least 135 children have been used as suicide bombers. UNICEF says children are killed, maimed, denied access to food and water, and pushed to the limits of suffering from malnutrition, disease, and trauma. It says this happens in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and other conflicts where the rights and needs of children are violated with impunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Yeah. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what is the scorecard of food insecurity in Africa? Find out more when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite childhood memory?
I was brought up from a father that was loving and who wants the best for his children. And I will always live with that memory.
I think my senior brothers were going to school, so I developed the interest of being part of them and start moving to the school myself without even being around officially into the school.
My favorite childhood memory, it's when, because I've been in a boarding school, usually when there are those school functions whereby students used to present, for example, music, dancing, that's all I can remember.
Because we could go there and they gave me a lot of popcorns. You know, if you go for the cinema, popcorn have to be there. Yeah, I could like eating popcorn.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. 4 million more Africans were food insecure this year as the number of people experiencing food insecurity in Africa rose to 224 million. Esther Ngumi is a researcher at Auburn University in Alabama. She says innovation in technology and new policies implemented by a number of countries have improved food security that could be adopted in countries struggling to feed their people.
First of all, their governments are very stable, and they've put food security as one of the important pillars in developing their countries. Secondly, they've also invested in some of the foundational important key elements of achieving food security. And by that, I mean irrigation, for example, because with the changing climate patterns, rain is no longer dependent. It's no longer coming at the times that it's supposed to come. And a lot of Africans and African countries still depend on rainfed agriculture. So some of these countries that are able to feed their countries, they are laying a lot of emphasis on irrigation.
What about the countries that are struggling? What do we know about them?
One of the things that we know is that their governments are not stable. And because the political climate is not good, so the governments are not being able to invest in some of these key, as I say, foundational things that are needed by governments to be able to feed their population. So instead of investing in irrigation, most of them are still fighting to ensure that their countries are stable. Because of the instability of the political climate, they're not adopting all these newer technologies. It's hard for even the newer technologies to infiltrate in these countries. Say we have new solar-powered irrigation technologies. A lot of entrepreneurs would not be able to set up this because they're also afraid of their life.
Do you have any other advice for countries like South Sudan who may see high levels of food insecurity this next year?
Yes, the first thing is while the political climate may not be stable, but governments can still roll out some of the most and key important elements. They could make sure that farmers, smallholder farmers in those countries, for example, have access to water. We know that without water, there's no farming. And with climate change making rains inaccessible, there needs to be, the irrigation has to be set up.
Now, the changes that you've seen, are they consistent from coast to coast? I mean, obviously, the land in Nigeria is going to be a lot different from the land in Somalia or Ethiopia. So how do different countries attribute that in their planning for food security?
Whether you are in Nigeria, whether you're in South Sudan, whether you're in Somalia, research shows that the soil is depleted. So initiatives that really pin down on improving the soil. And second, irrigation. We also know that all those countries still face the lack of water. So there are some of the key initiatives that are going to be just work across the different African countries. To say, you know, irrigation is going to be key. Initiatives that focus on soil health are going to be key. Improved varieties. But of course, those improved varieties differ depending on the countries, because a maize variety that works well for Nigeria may not work well for Tanzania, it may not work well for Kenya. But it also is going to also depend on the researchers and the scientific institutions in those different countries that are working to come up with this country applicable initiative.
That was Esther Ngumbi, a researcher at Auburn University, speaking to Ayen Bior today from Alabama. A court in Cameroon has freed Patrice Nganga, a prize-winning author and Cameroon-born U.S. citizen, jailed for threatening the life of Cameroon President Paul Biya on social media. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Issa Chiruma, Cameroon's Minister of Communication, says the court freed Patrice Nganga on Wednesday after Cameroonian President Paul Biya ordered an end to legal proceedings against Nganga.
Mr. Nganga violated the law of our nation, threatened to kill the head of state, was detained just for investigation. But the head of state decided to stop the procedure and to let him go. They found two passports on him, one passport, Cameroonian passport, and American passport. The law of our nation does not accept the dual nationality. That reason why they withdrew his Cameroonian passport and they let him with the American passport, and he was expelled according to our own laws.
Nganga was arrested on December 6 and accused of threatening in a Facebook post to shoot Biya. He was facing a January 19 trial on charges that included seeking to justify a crime, contempt, and assault threats. On Wednesday, the author, who won the Grand Literacy Prize of Black Africa and teaches literature at New York's Stony Brook University, was taken from his cell to a Yaoundé court where the state prosecutor asked for his release. Chiruma says his Cameroonian passport was seized and Patrice was expelled with his U.S. passport.
I would like to advise him. He is an American. Let him threaten to kill the head of state of America and he will see what will happen to him.
Nganga is a fierce critic of President Biya. He was arrested in Douala, Cameroon's economic capital city, 3 weeks ago as he was boarding a flight to leave Cameroon. Nganga wrote a critical article for the weekly news magazine Jeune Afrique on Cameroon's handling of the violent secessionist movement that has paralyzed school and businesses in the English-speaking areas of the country for more than a year. The crisis started when English-speaking lawyers and teachers complained of marginalization from the French-speaking majority in the bilingual country. It escalated to violent clashes between armed separatists and the military that have left dozens dead since October. Several thousand people, including writers, had signed an online petition to pressure Biya to release the writer. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
From Yaoundé, we move to Harare, where media freedom was restricted under former President Robert Mugabe. State media has been Mugabe's mouthpiece, and private media imposed its own regulations to avoid government retaliation. Reporter Kuzai Zenevashi takes a look at how the local media covered the recent coup, which they did not anticipate.
The military intervention, which ended 37 years of rule by Robert Mugabe, took the government-backed daily paper, The Herald, completely by surprise. Working quickly, the publishers shelved the planned edition for the day and put out a new one that afternoon. The takeover came as voters plan to go to the polls 8 months from now. Election reporting has been high on the agenda. Munyaradzi Dodo is the editor of Open Parli, a citizen journalist-driven platform that covers parliament business and other political events.
Well, it was very hard. It stretched our team to the max. There was a lot of misinformation and fake news was at an all-time high. Lots of press conferences that we had to attend to. The coup happened in the middle of a scheduled parliamentary break. The whole country was in a limbo in terms of news and the way forward, and everyone was just speculating.
At the time, the local media added to the confusion with some questionable and unconfirmed reports. Pascal Kunyeda is a media analyst.
The problem now is local media, they've taken leads from social media when they are doing their stories. Local media tends to lose its credibility, especially over the last few weeks. The privately owned media have lost some good ground because they've been falling prey to those social media fake news.
In Mugabe's era, a good number of Zimbabweans had stopped listening to news from the state media, which were considered to be one-sided and untrustworthy. However, during the takeover, government officials became the only reliable source of credible news. Kunyeda explains.
At that time, those who were in levers of power were controlling. And now that the military had taken over, they went on to utilize ZBC and Zim Paper as their official mouthpieces. That's why you realize now on state media, that was where you would get credible sources of information because the army would come in with a periodic update.
Taking lessons from covering the coup, Dodo touches on some of the things they will have to improve on to guard against fake news.
I think it's very important to have strong contacts because it's very easy for real information to be manipulated. It's very important to use video and an audio of the original sources because text can be manipulated. Verifying sources, getting established linkages from in high offices who can verify and confirm what's happening.
Lucky Aroni is the co-founder and producer of Bustop TV, an online platform that runs a news edition that keeps Zimbabweans informed and entertained with their comic delivery. He says they are taking lessons from covering the coup and are crowdfunding to improve their coverage.
From that, we learned that we need to start streaming our news from location as it happens. Not that we're going shoot and upload later on, but we need to upload. We need to start streaming live. After the coup, we realized that we need more equipment, especially to stream live from location. So we've decided to start a GoFundMe campaign to raise that money to buy equipment.
The GoFundMe campaign is ongoing, and Bustop TV says this is largely to prepare for elections that are a few months away. Kunyeda says the attitude of the government officials towards the media may be changing. In the past, officials withheld information from the private media, but the new administration seems to be open to finding new ways of working with diverse and evolving information outlets. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with a peace song by Vivian Nyachan. We've been listening to Vivian Nyachan with the song about peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you joining us. We'd like to know what you think about this show. You can write to us. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also check us out on Facebook site. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus.